Chapter 28. The lobby of the Prince de Galles was empty as Ravitch came downstairs. A portable radio was playing quietly on the reception desk. A couple of scrub women were working in the corners. Ravitch walked across quickly and inconspicuously. He looked at the clock opposite the door. It was 5 in the morning. He went up the Avenue Georges V and over to Fouquet's. No one was sitting there. The restaurant had been closed for some time. He paused for a moment, then he stopped a taxi and drove to the Scheherazade. Morozov was standing in front of the door and looked at him questioningly.
"Nothing," Ravitch said. "As I thought, you could not have expected it today."
"You could. Today is the 14th day."
"You can't count on one day. Have you been in the Prince de Galles all the time?"
"Yes, from morning up to now."
"He'll call up tomorrow," Morozov said. "He may have had something to do today, or may have left a day later."
"I have to operate tomorrow morning."
"You won't call that early."
Ravitch did not reply. He was looking at a taxi out of which a gigolo in a white tuxedo had stepped. A pale woman with big teeth followed him. Morozov opened the door for them. Suddenly the street smelled of Chanel 5. The woman limped a little. The gigolo walked lazily behind her after paying for the taxi. The woman waited for him at the door. Her eyes were green in the light of the lamps. The pupils were contracted.
"At this time of day he certainly won't call," Morozov said as he returned.
Ravitch did not answer.
"If you give me the key, I can go up at 8, Morozov declared. "I can wait then until you get back."
"Well, you must sleep."
"Nonsense. I can sleep on your bed if I want to. No one will call. But I can do it if it puts you at ease."
"I'll have to operate until 11.
"All right, give me the key. I wouldn't like you to sew the ovaries of a lady of the Faubourg Saint-Germain to her stomach in your excitement. She might vomit up a child. Have you the key?"
"Yes, here." Morozov put the key into his pocket. Then he took out a case with peppermint troche and offered them to Ravitch. Ravitch shook his head. Morozov took a few out and threw them into his mouth. They disappeared behind his beard like small white birds flying into a wood.
"Refreshing," he declared.
"Have you ever sat in a plush hole the entire day and waited?" Ravitch asked.
"Longer, haven't you?"
"Yes, but not for something like this."
"Didn't you take anything along to read?"
"Enough, but I didn't read anything. How long will you be busy here?" Morozov opened the door of a taxi. It was crowded with Americans. He let them in.
"Well, at least another 2 hours," he said, when he came back. "You see what's on. The maddest summer for years. Everything filled to capacity. Joan is in there, too."
"Is she?"
"Yes. With a different man, in case you're interested."
"No," Ravitch said. He turned, ready to leave. "Then I'll be seeing you tomorrow."
"Ravitch!"
Morozov called after him. Ravitch came back. Morozov drew the key out of his pocket.
"Here. You must be able to get into your room in the Prince de Galles. I won't see you before tomorrow. Leave the door open when you go out."
"I won't sleep at the Prince de Galles." Ravitch took the key.
"I sleep in the Internationale. It's better if my face is seen as little as possible over there." "You should sleep there. One doesn't live in a hotel where one doesn't sleep. It's better so, in case the police inquire at the reception desk."
"That's true. But it's also better to be able to prove that I've lived all the time in the Internationale, in case they do inquire. I've arranged everything in the Prince de Galles, the bed rumpled, the washstand, bath towels, and everything else used, so that it looks as if I'd left early in the morning."
"All right. Then give me the key again."
Ravitch shook his head. "It's better they shouldn't see you there."
"Well, that doesn't matter."
"It does, Boris. We don't want to be idiots. Your beard is not ordinary. Besides, you are right. I must act and live as if nothing in particular were the matter. If Harker really should call up tomorrow morning, then he'd call again in the afternoon, too. If I didn't count on that, I'd be a nervous wreck within a day."
"Where are you going now?"
"To bed. We can't expect him to call at this time of day."
"I can meet you somewhere later if you want me to." No, Boris. I hope I'll be asleep by the time you're free here. I must operate at 8. Morozov looked at him doubtfully. Good. Then I'll drop in on you tomorrow afternoon at the Prince de Galles. In case something happens before, give me a ring at the hotel. Yes. The streets, the city, the reddish sky, flickering red and white and blue behind the buildings, wind playing around the corners of the bistro like an affectionate cat. People, fresh air, after a day lived through in a sticky hotel room. Ravitch walked along the avenue behind the Scheherazade. The fenced-in trees hesitantly exhaled a memory of woods and greenery into the leaden night. Suddenly he felt empty and exhausted, ready to drop. If I'd let go of it, something within him thought, if I'd let go of it completely, forget it, strip it off as a snake strips off its outworn skin. What does it matter to me, this melodrama of an almost forgotten past? What does even this person matter to me, this little incidental instrument, this insignificant tool in a dark fragment of the Middle Ages, of a solar eclipse of Central Europe? What did it still matter to him? A prostitute tried to tempt him into a doorway. In the dark of the door she opened her dress. It was made so that it opened like a robe when she undid the belt. The pale flesh glimmered indistinctly. Long black stockings, black sockets of eyes in whose shadows one no longer saw any eyes. Frail, decaying flesh which seemed already to phosphoresce. A pimp with a cigarette sticking to his upper lip leaned against a tree and stared at him. A few vegetable vans passed by. Horses, heads bowed, muscles working powerfully under their skins. The spicy smell of herbs, of heads of cauliflower which looked like petrified brains in green leaves, the red of tomatoes, the baskets with beans, onions, cherries, and celery. What did it still matter to him, one more or less? One more or less out of 100,000 men who were just as bad or even worse? One less. He stopped abruptly. That was it. He was quite awake all of a sudden. That was it. That was what had made them grow. The fact that one got tired, that one wanted to forget, that one thought, what does it matter to me? That was it. One less, yes, one less. It was nothing, but it was also everything. Everything. Slowly he drew a cigarette out of his pocket and slowly lighted it. And suddenly, while the yellow light of the match illuminated his palms like a cave with gorges of lines in it, he became aware that nothing could keep him from killing Harker. Everything depended on it in a strange way. It was suddenly much more than just a personal act of vengeance. It was as if he would make himself guilty of an immense crime if he did not do it. As if something in the world would be lost forever if he did not act. At the same time, he knew exactly that it wasn't so. But nevertheless, and far beyond explanation and logic, the dark knowledge pulsed in his blood that he had to do it, as if invisible waves would emanate from it and far greater events happen later. He knew that Harker was only a small official of horror and not of much significance. But suddenly he knew, too, that it was infinitely important to kill him. The light in the cave of his hands went out. He threw the match away. The dawn hung over the trees. A silver fabric held up by the pizzicato of the awakening sparrows. He looked about in astonishment. Something had happened to him. An invisible court had held a sitting and a sentence had been pronounced. He saw the trees with extreme clarity, the yellow wall of a house, the grey colour of an iron fence beside him, the street in the blue mist. He had the feeling that he would never forget them, and he knew that he would kill Harker, and that it was no longer his own little affair, but far more. A beginning. He passed the entrance of the Osiris. A few drunks staggered out. Their eyes were glassy, their faces red. Ravitch glanced after them. They walked to the curb. There was no taxi there. They cursed for a while, and then they walked on, heavy, strong, and noisy. They were speaking German. Ravitch had intended to go to the hotel. Now he changed his mind. He recalled Roland's words that there had often been German tourists in the Osiris during the last few months. He entered. Roland was standing at the bar, cool, observant, in her black gouvernante's uniform. The music box blared resoundingly against the Egyptian walls. "Roland!" Ravitch said. She turned around. Ravitch, you haven't been here for a long time. It's good that you've come.
Why?
He stood beside her at the bar and looked around the place. There were no longer many customers there. They were hunched sleepily at the tables here and there.
I'm leaving here, Roland said. I go in a week.
Forever? She nodded and took a telegram out of the neck of her dress.
Here.
Ravitch opened it and gave it back to her.
Your aunt? She finally died?
Yes. I'll go back. I've told Madame. She is furious, but she understands. Jeannette must replace me. I still have to break her in.
Roland laughed. Poor Madame. She wanted to show off at Cannes this year. Her villa is crowded with guests by now. She became a countess a year ago, married a pimp from Toulouse. She pays him 5,000 francs a month as long as he doesn't leave Toulouse. Now she's got to stay here.
Will you open your café?
Yes. I run around all day ordering things. One can get them cheaper in Paris. Chintz for the curtains. What do you say to this pattern?
She drew out of the neck of her dress a crumpled piece of material, flowers on a yellow background.
Wonderful, Ravitch declared. I'll get it at a discount of 30%, last year's stock.
Roland's eyes radiated warmth and tenderness. I'll save 375 francs. Not bad, eh?
Marvellous.
Will you marry?
Yes.
Why do you want to marry? Why don't you wait a while and attend to everything you want to do first?
Roland laughed.
You don't understand business, Ravitch. It won't work without a man. A man belongs in it. I know what I'm doing, all right.
There she stood, strong, secure, calm. She had thought over everything. The man belonged in the business.
Don't have your money put in his name right away, Ravitch said. Just wait to see how everything will work out.
She laughed again.
I know how it will work out. We are sensible. We need each other in the business. A man is no man if his wife has the money. I don't want a pimp. I must be able to respect my husband. I can't do that if he has to come to me every minute to ask for money. Don't you see that?
Yes, Ravitch said, without seeing it.
Fine. She nodded contentedly. Do you want a drink?
Nothing. I must go. Just dropped in. I've got to work tomorrow morning.
She looked at him.
You are completely sober. Don't you want a girl?
No.
Roland directed two girls with a light movement of her hand to a man who was sitting on a banquette, asleep. The others were romping around. Only a few of them were still sitting on the hassocks which stood in two rows along the middle walk. The others slid on the smooth floor of the corridor, like children on ice in winter. Two of them at a gallop would drag a third in a squatting position through the long corridor. Their flying hair was dishevelled, their breasts were swinging, their shoulders shone, their wisps of silk no longer hid anything. They screamed with pleasure, and suddenly the Osiris was an Arcadian scene of classic innocence.
Summer, Roland said. One has to grant them some freedom in the mornings.
She looked at Ravitch.
Thursday is my last evening. Madame is giving a party for me. Will you come?
Thursday?
Yes.
Thursday, Ravitch thought. In 7 days. 7 days. That is like 7 years. Thursday. It would be done by then. Thursday. Who was able to think so far ahead?
Of course, he said.
Where?
Here, at 6 o'clock.
All right. I'll be here. Good night, Roland.
Good night, Ravitch.
It happened while he was applying the retractor. It happened swiftly, alarming and hot. He hesitated a moment. The open red abdominal cavity, the thin steam from the hot damp dressings with which the intestines were held up, the blood trickling from the delicate veins next to the clips. Then suddenly he saw Eugenie looking at him with an inquiring glance. He saw Weber's large face with all its pores and every hair of his moustache under the metallic light, and he collected himself and went on working calmly. He sewed. His hands sewed. The incision was closing. He could feel the sweat running from his armpits. It ran down his body.
"Will you finish?" he asked Weber.
Yes. Is something the matter?
No, the heat. Not enough sleep.
Ravitch saw Eugenie's look. It can happen, Eugenie, he said, even to the righteous.
The room seemed to rock for a moment. A mad exhaustion. Weber went on sewing. Ravitch automatically helped him. His tongue was thick. The palate was like cotton wool. He breathed very slowly.
Poppies, something in him thought. Poppies in Flanders. Red, open poppy blossoms. The shameless secret. Life, so close beneath the hands with the knife. A trembling running down one's arms. The magnetic contact from far off, from a distant death.
I can't operate any more, he thought. This has to be settled first.
Weber painted the closed incision.
Finished.
Eugenie lowered the foot end of the operating table. The stretcher was rolled out noiselessly.
Cigarette?
Weber asked.
No, I must leave. I've got to attend to something. Is there anything more to be done?
No.
Weber looked at Ravitch with surprise.
Why are you in such a hurry? Do you want a vermouth and soda or something else cool?
Nothing. I've got to hurry. I didn't realize it was so late. Adieu, Weber.
He left quickly.
A taxi, he thought when he was outside. A taxi, quick. He saw a Citroën approaching him and stopped it.
To the Hotel Prince de Galles, quick.
I must tell Weber he will have to get along without me for a few days, he thought. It won't do. I'll go crazy if I suddenly think during an operation that Harker may be calling at just that moment.
He paid the taxi and walked quickly through the entrance hall.
It seemed to take an endless time before the elevator came. He walked down the broad corridor and opened the door. The telephone. He lifted the receiver as if it were heavy.
This is Van Horn. Have there been any calls for me?
Just a moment, sir.
Ravitch waited. The voice of the telephone operator came again.
No, no calls.
Thank you.
Morozov came in the afternoon.
Have you had anything to eat?
He asked.
No, I was waiting for you. I thought we could eat here together.
Nonsense. That would attract attention. Nobody eats in his room in Paris unless he's sick. Go and have something to eat. I'll stay here. No one will telephone at this time of day. Everyone is eating now. Sacred custom. Nevertheless, in case he should call, I'll act as your valet. Ask for his number and tell him you'll be back in half an hour.
Ravitch hesitated.
You are right, he said then. I'll be back in 20 minutes.
Take your time. You've waited long enough.
Don't get nervous now.
Are you going to Fouquet's?
Yes.
Ask for the open 37 Vouvray. I've just had some. First rate.
All right.
Ravitch went down. He crossed the street and walked along the terrace. Then he walked through the restaurant. Harker was not there. He took his place at an empty table on the terrace beside the Avenue Georges V and ordered bœuf à la mode, salad, goat cheese, and a carafe of Vouvray. He observed himself as he ate. He forced himself to notice that the wine tasted light and sparkling. He ate slowly. He looked around. He saw the sky hanging above the Arc de Triomphe like a blue silk flag. He ordered a second cup of coffee. He felt its bitter taste. Slowly he lighted a cigarette. He did not want to hurry. He sat for a while longer. He watched the people pass by. Then he rose and walked across to the Prince de Galles and had forgotten everything.
"How was the Vouvray?" Morozov asked.
"Good."
Morozov got a miniature chessboard out of his pocket.
"Do you want to play a game?"
"Yes."
They put the chessmen into the holes in the board. Morozov sat down in a chair. Ravitch was sitting on the sofa.
"I don't think I can stay here more than 3 or 4 days without a passport," he said.
"Has the office asked for it?"
"Not yet. Sometimes they ask for passports with visas at the registration desk. That's why I moved in at night. The night porter didn't ask questions. I told him I'd need a room for 5 days.
"They aren't so particular in exclusive hotels."
"If they should come and ask for my passport, it would be difficult."
"They won't come for the time being. I inquired at the Georges V and the Ritz. Did you register as an American?"
No, as a Dutchman from Utrecht. It doesn't fit the German name exactly. That's why I changed it somewhat to be on the safe side.
Van Horn, not Fon. It will sound just the same when Harker calls up.
Right. I still think it will work. You certainly didn't rent one of the cheap rooms. They won't bother about you.
I hope not.
It's a pity you gave Horn as your name. I know of a perfect carte d'identité, valid for a year more. It belonged to a friend of mine who died 7 months ago. At the coroner's inquest, we declared he was a German refugee without papers, so we saved the certificate and kept it valid. It does not matter to him to be buried somewhere as Josef Weiss, but two refugees have already lived on his papers. Ivan Klug, not a Russian name. The photo is blurred, taken in profile, unstamped, easily exchangeable. It's better the way it is now, Ravitch said. When I move out of here, Horn will no longer exist and there will be no papers.
It would have been safer as far as the police are concerned. But they won't come. They don't come into hotels where one pays more than 100 francs for an apartment. I know a refugee at the Ritz who's been living there without papers for the last 5 years. The only one who knows about it is the night porter.
Have you thought over what you're going to do if the fellows here should nevertheless ask for papers?
Of course. My passport is at the Argentine embassy for a visa. I'll promise them to call for it next day. Then I'll leave the suitcase here and won't come back. There is time for that. The first inquiry would come from the management, not from the police. I count on that. Only then it would be all up here.
It will work.
They played until 8:30.
Now go and have a bite, Morozov said. I'll wait here, then I'll have to go.
I'll eat here later.
Nonsense. Go now and eat a decent meal. When that fellow calls, you will probably have to drink with him first. In that case, you'd better have had enough to eat. Do you know where you want to go with him?
Yes.
I mean, in case he still wants to see or drink something.
Yes. I know a lot of places where everyone minds his own business.
Well, go and have something to eat now. Don't drink anything. Eat heavy, fat things.
All right. Ravitch walked across to Fouquet's again. All this was not real, he felt. He must be reading it in a book, or seeing it in a melodramatic movie, or he must be dreaming it. He walked by both sides of Fouquet's again. The terraces were crowded. He checked on each individual table. Harker was nowhere. He sat at a small table next to the door so he could watch both the entrance and the street. At an adjoining table, two women were talking about Schiaparelli and Meinbacher. A man with a thin beard was sitting with them, saying nothing. On the other side, a few young Frenchmen were discussing politics. One was for the Croix de Feu, one for the Communists. The others made fun of both of them. In between, they all studied two beautiful, self-assured American girls who were drinking vermouth. Ravitch watched the street while he ate. He was not stupid enough to disbelieve in accidents. Only in good literature are there no accidents. Life was daily filled with the most absurd ones. He stayed at Fouquet's for 30 minutes. It was easier this time than at noon. Once more he walked around the corner along the Champs-Élysées and then back to the hotel.
"Here is the key to your car," Morozov said. "I've exchanged it. Now it is a blue Talbot with leather seats. The other one had corded seats. Leather can be washed more easily. It is a cabriolet. You can drive with the top up or down, but always leave the window open. If you must shoot when the car is closed, shoot so that the bullet goes through the open window to avoid any bullet traces in the car. I've rented it for 2 weeks. On no account bring it back to the garage afterwards. Leave it in one of the side streets to air out. It is now parked in the Rue de Berry, opposite the Lancaster."
"Good," Ravitch said. He put the key next to the telephone.
"Here are the registration papers for the car. I couldn't get you a driver's license. Didn't want to ask too many people."
"I don't need it. I drove the whole time in Antibes without one." Ravitch put the registration for the car next to the keys.
"Park the car in a different street tonight," Morozov said.
Melodrama, Ravitch thought. Bad melodrama.
"I'll do it.
Thanks, Boris."
"I wish I could come with you."
"I don't. This is the sort of thing one does alone."
"Come to my place and wake me up if I'm no longer in front of the Scheherazade."
"I'll come in any case, no matter whether something happens or not."
All right. So long, Ravitch.
So long, Boris.
Ravitch closed the door behind Morozov. Suddenly the room was very quiet. He sat down in a corner of the sofa. He looked at the hangings. They were of blue material with a border. He had come to know them better in these 2 days than any others with which he had lived for many years. He knew the mirrors. He knew the grey velours on the floor, with the dark spot near the window. He knew every line of the table, of the bed, of the chair covers. He knew everything so exactly that it made him sick. Only the telephone he did not know.